This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. Tonight on After Paradise, it's been 26 days since the campfire started. Butte County health workers heard today from the CEO of Adventist Health about the future of the Feather River Hospital and other clinics in the area. We'll have a report. Plus, a tour through FEMA's Disaster Recovery Center at the old Sears building will take you through the process of registering for help and benefits. And first thing we do, we expose all the lawyers who go after clients in the immediate aftermath of disasters like this one. We want to hear your questions and comments. Leave a message for us at 433-4887 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Tuesday, December 4th, 2018, this is After Paradise. If there is any good news to be had when dealing with the numbers surrounding a catastrophic event like the campfire, it's when numbers of the dead and missing go down. That's what's happened in the last 24 hours or so. The death toll now stands at 85, down from 88, because of remains that were identified to be from one person instead of three. And the list of those reported missing, which topped 500 a little more than a week ago, now stands at 11, according to the Butte County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Corey Honey said authorities are still working to find and identify those 11 and will do so until all leads have been exhausted. Meantime, executives from Adventist Health met with their employees at the neighborhood church here in Chico today. They came to discuss the fate of the Feather River Medical Center, which was damaged and partially destroyed in the campfire. They say that while some of the clinics will reopen, the only hospital in Paradise, which was also one of the biggest employers in the area, will not reopen until 2020. KQED's Michelle Wiley was there, and she joins me now. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Tess.
What reasoning did they give as to why the hospital will not open?
So while there might not be a lot of damage externally, they might look a lot of buildings at the hospital look okay on the outside. What they're really concerned about is the inside of the hospital, which has a lot of different kinds of smoke damage. There's been, like, from the flooding, there's issues. Here is Adventist Health Chief Executive Officer Scott Reiner.
A hospital is not just four walls. It has a lot of infrastructure. It has, in this case, the fire really did a lot of damage to the core infrastructure, heating, air conditioning, and when you lose power for a certain period of time, you know, you have other issues that can happen related to mold and so forth. So the most important thing is safety of the organization, and that's a long process of recovery. There's smoke, there's water damage, and so forth.
And the other factor is there's a lot of different kinds of standards of upkeep that a hospital has to have that's different than any other areas. So, you know, you can't have someone who's just had open heart surgery in a hospital that isn't up to these very high standards of care.
All right. Well, so then what does that mean for all these hundreds of employees who don't have a place to work?
So Adventist has a few different programs for them. They do have a fire relief fund they're offering to pay people's salaries out until the 5th of February. And the other program that they have going is at the meeting today, they had these career placement folks who are trying to match employees with other Adventist hospitals across the state. And that way they can keep them in the family and help them find other jobs. But one of the issues here is that, you know, there might be a job for you, but it might be in L.A. And if you have been living in Chico and don't want to move to L.A., then and that's your only option, then you have to find employment somewhere else. And that's the case for Amanda Lindemuth McLaughlin. She worked as a respiratory therapist at Feather River.
I may have to go elsewhere at my expense, if I have any expense.
So when your choice is staying at the same hospital but moving across the state or finding a new place to work, I think that that metric for people is just adding on to the issues that they already had of maybe they lost their house, maybe they don't have a job now, and now this, and it just got a lot more complicated.
And Michelle, I assume all of this applies not just for former employees of Feather River, but lots of clinics throughout the county as well.
Yes. So executives said they're going to do their best to open the clinics, all the clinics that they can. There's one on Skyway that they said they should have open in the next few weeks, which is really exciting for employees there. And I mean, for people who need health care in the area, because that's going to be so important as folks start moving back into their homes. But for some, I think the question, again, just like what so many people are grappling with here is, do I want to go back? Am I going to stay here? Should I try and rebuild my home? That question for healthcare professionals is the same as for everyone else in Paradise and the surrounding areas.
All right, Michelle Wiley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pacific Gas and Electric Company is in the crosshairs for its possible role in causing the campfire. The State Public Utility Commission has launched several investigations into whether PG&E's power lines helped spark what became an out-of-control inferno on November 8th. Where there is blame to be had, there are lawyers. And dozens of firms have rushed into Chico and Oroville since the fire to sign up clients for lawsuits. Some reported tactics, such as seeking out potential clients in evacuation shelters, have raised eyebrows. But are they illegal? Jackson Cantrell has our report.
Libby Andresen is staying with her mother in a makeshift shelter at the East Avenue Church in Chico. There, she has received food, shelter, and also some unwanted visitors.
A lot of people coming in and taking advantage. There was some attorneys in here handing out business cards and, you know, stacks of paperwork like this. It was, they couldn't put it together.
Attorneys are descending on Chico to sue PG&E. Andresen was particularly disturbed when she saw representatives approaching some of the older folks at the shelter.
And a lot of the people here came from assisted living, and they lost their caregivers, so there wasn't a lot.
She told me the attorney she eventually retained was less intrusive than some of the other firms.
But our attorney, he just gave me some forms, that just hand them out, and he gave me self-addressed stamped envelopes. Just have name, address, phone number, and send it to me, and I'll contact them individually and just work out everybody's private incident, whatever. And I thought that was more tactful than to coming around here. It just seems like vultures.
Lawyers have also taken to the web and airwaves, so much so that advertising for firms lining up to sue PG&E, it's become ubiquitous.
I'm going to hold PG&E accountable and assist you through the insurance process. That's why I'm working with a team of attorneys and professionals to represent fire survivors like us. We will get through this. Together.
I also saw dozens of flyers for meetings around Chico and Oroville. I was at one last Thursday at the Chico Family Masonic Center.
For personal injury or for wrongful death, the statute of limitations, and that includes emotional distress.
When I left the room, there was a different law firm meeting down the hall. I would have recorded it too if I wasn't late for my next PG&E lawsuit information session.
So any monies that you collect from your insurance companies, we will not take one penny.
The flyers, the methods of solicitation, and the deluge of advertising gave me an uneasy feeling. So I went to Anu Chopra, the vice president of the Butte County Bar Association, to figure out if these practices are acceptable.
On the State Bar of California website, they have listed certain things that California law prohibits lawyers to do. For example, soliciting clients at an accident scene, or soliciting clients who, due to their physical, emotional, mental state, may not be able to have reasonable judgment about hiring an attorney. Our survivors from the Butte County campfire are going through a lot of trauma. Some of them are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. They're under severe emotional and mental distress, and this probably is not the time where they can have sound judgment to sign important legal documents to hire attorneys.
With Chopra was Michael Shepard. He's been practicing law for 43 years and serves as the treasurer of the Butte County Bar.
We have done some homework and have called these law firms who have been on Facebook. The person answering the phone will not even identify the law firm to which they're connected. Instead, they run under some catch name to attract clients.
I pull out a flyer I saw in downtown Chico.
I actually have a couple of flyers here.
I am not going to comment on any specific law firms.
What about just the way something's presented? Like here there's a couple of firms. I'm not going to mention any names. Could I get just a general comment on it?
The flyer that I'm looking at, I have no idea who the attorneys are. I am very concerned about pamphlets that don't identify the attorneys, don't show what their experience is, and don't show any track records.
I spoke to Rafi Balabanian, an attorney with Edelson PC. This was the same law firm that Andresen described as more tactful when they had her pass out paperwork at the East Avenue Church. Edelson is a San Francisco firm that describes itself as a leader in privacy and tech-related class actions. It's partnering with Leif Cabraser to sue PG&E.
Leif Cabraser has been in the lead of fire litigation for years and years, their lead counsel in other fire cases against PG&E.
I heard from some people at East Avenue Church that many firms, including yours, were coming to shelters to try to retain clients.
We didn't. So that wasn't our firms. The only time we were at the shelter was when we were invited to the shelter by one of our clients who wanted to introduce us to her friends and neighbors. We never went into the shelter. We never passed out retainers.
Whether firms break specific rules or not, the question is, should attorneys be aggressively targeting clients in the first place? Especially this soon after something so devastating. Well, there is a big incentive. Here's Shepard again, who says that regardless of a firm's intentions, picking up more clients now means more money.
The more clients that you have, the larger the recovery is going to be, and so the more fees you're going to make. There's nothing wrong with that. However, if you're just signing up people and then you file a lawsuit and you quickly get a settlement, that's going to be a fast buck and a cheaper settlement.
As for survivors, there is no rush to sue PG&E. Chopra says the first order of business should be taking care of yourself and your loved ones and dealing with your insurance company.
This is a time where a community needs love and support and all the resources so they can survive. The immediate need is to deal with your insurance company and talk to the insurance company first. You don't need legal representation for that. If they give you any pushback and are not meeting the policy requirements, then we suggest that folks call the California State Insurance Commissioner.
And finally, if you decide to sue PG&E, Shepard says get multiple recommendations from familiar attorneys you trust. If you are not familiar with an attorney, he says check in with someone local.
I'm advising these folks, slow down. You don't have to make a decision today. You don't have to make a decision next week. Right now, your emotions are running high. Take your time. It is important that we all reach out to each other right now and give comfort and support. That's what's needed right now.
If you have received a solicitation or have any other legal questions, you should check in with the Butte County Bar. They're offering a free legal clinic twice a week. This is Tuesdays from 4 to 7 p.m. and Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Disaster Relief Center in the Old Sears Building on Forest Avenue. For NSPR News, I'm Jackson Cantrell.
NSPR commentator Kim Weir usually spends her airtime highlighting places to visit in California. Today, she's staying closer to home, or what used to be her home, in Paradise.
I live in Paradise, and I love it. No one has been more surprised by this than me. I grew up in Chico, the college town just down the hill, and like many Flatlanders, I helped perpetuate local prejudices about the place. When I was 16 and still knew everything, I dismissed Paradise as little more than local headquarters for the John Birch Society, which it was back then. There is still cranky conservatism around town and worse, but everything and everyone else, too. So even a low-rent rider with too many critters can feel right at home. Plus, Paradise has about zero pretension, which, sadly, Chico can no longer boast. So I love it here. There, rather, given that right now I'm living down the hill again. But when I moved up the hill, some years back, to escape the summer heat and too hot home prices, I got such a kick out of that Chamber of Commerce bumper sticker. Paradise, a little cooler than Chico. Dang straight, it really is. Or was. It's hard knowing what Paradise is now, even harder what it will be. With every new telling of our collective horror story, that mad dash through flames, fear, and gridlocked roads, every newscast panning again over street after street of smoldering ruins, every shocking new total in the campfire count of the missed and the dead, that cool, piney, panic-free Paradise fades further. With luck, these new memories, so unwanted, will burn through fast, white hot, and turn to ash too. Luck. I am one of the lucky ones. I'm alive. I got out safely with 6 chickens, 2 dogs, and my dad's old cat. Plus, I had a welcoming place to go once I made it down the hill. I'm a homeowner too, so there was help with even the initial chaos of dislocation, financial help. And my little piece of paradise, all 595 square feet of it, still stands. Mixed in with amazement, no other house survives on my side of the street. There is guilt, knowing that. Given the war zone all around, the bombed-out landscape, the nearness of so many final losses. Built in 1945, my little house was the first on my street, I've been told. It gracefully stood up to the test of time long before I moved in. Whoever built it so solidly, right after World War II, knew what they were doing in other ways, too. Building it at an odd angle to the street, but the correct one for passive solar. Thin winter sun through one picture window heats most of the house. Shade from a massive blue oak protected that same window from heat come summer, at least until a decade or so ago, when that leafy giant finally lost its footing and thundered to ground, taking out my neighbor's garage on the way down. My house still stands, but I have lost my home, like everyone else in paradise. Being a refugee from paradise is not about losing a house, all that stuff inside and out, though that might be part of it, a hugely painful part. It's about losing home, that sense of home, of belonging in a place, which is so much bigger than the comfort of any house, the familiarity of any street. The fire is over, but home is still disappearing. Friends and neighbors are leaving. We're all starting over. We will find home again, even those who will never return to paradise, this particular one. We'll belong again somewhere. Home is where the heart is, the proverb goes. Pretty hokey that, I always thought. But now I get it. Now I understand that wisdom. We will love our lives again. Wherever we finally go, we will find refuge and comfort. We will be home again, because what matters most to us, what we love, is home.
Kim Weir's travel show, Up the Road, can be heard Wednesday afternoons and Thursday mornings on NSPR. You are listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. We'll have more just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Viglund. The old Sears building at 20th and Forest Avenue here in Chico hasn't featured drills and lawnmowers for more than a year. It sat there as an empty shell of Americana until about 3 weeks ago, when it became the headquarters of the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Disaster Assistance Center. Now some 1,500 people move through its halls every day, hoping to put at least some of the pieces of their lives back together in the wake of the campfire. But officials at FEMA say the numbers of people coming in for help are somewhat lower than expected, given the magnitude of the disaster. So tonight, for those who, for whatever reason, have not yet registered, we are going to walk you through what happens when you apply for the assistance that you've paid for with your tax dollars.
How we doing, folks? No knives or weapons of any kind? Okay, is it your first time here? Okay, so you have an appointment? Okay, you head right over there. No knives, weapons of any kind?
Yes, you will have to give up your knives when you walk in, and your knife will have plenty of company in the box at the entrance. If it's your first visit, you'll take a number and go to a waiting area just off to the left. While you're waiting, you can walk over to the booth for the Butte County Library and pick up a couple of books, yours to keep. Frank Mansell is a public information officer with FEMA and my tour guide to the complex.
Once they're past this point, they're free to roam the facility, which is a facility of federal, volunteer, and state agency resources. Everything that people would need to help put their lives back together following the fire.
Give us a rundown of some of the agencies that are here. I mean, just from the entryway, I see Social Security, unemployment assistance, the DMV, presumably helping people get their IDs back.
And IDs, driver's licenses. So there's state disaster unemployment here for individuals that qualify. Disaster unemployment is different than regular unemployment. You can get your passport renewed here. Post office is here if you want to set up a post office box.
So we've been admitted and we've got our number. When our number is called, where's the first place we're going to go?
Then the first place that you'll probably be directed to go is to the FEMA counter for registration.
All right, shall we go?
We shall.
As we head toward the back of the building, we pass a sign for submitting DNA if you've reported anyone missing. That number stands at 11 as of today. We also pass the DMV, and a bit further down, an area with mental health counselors on standby. Once we arrive at the far end of the site, Mansell introduces me to George Jackson, who's in charge of the whole facility. We sat down at a long row of tables.
So, my name is Tess, and I'm a victim of the Paradise wildfire, and I've just walked in the door and been seated in front of you. What do we do?
We're going to register you.
And what does that involve?
Well, that involves you'll need your name, your address, your Social Security number, and at that point, that's the information that's to get started. So once you have that information, then we will ask questions like, were you affected by the fire? Are you a renter or are you an owner? Do you have insurance? So how many people are in your household?
So about how long will this process take, answering these questions?
Yeah, the process is going to take somewhere between 18 to 20 minutes because this being the government, you know we're going to have to read you a privacy statement. That's going to take probably about half that time. We're going to ask you whether or not you want your money deposited. If you're eligible for funds, do you want it directly deposited into your account or do you want us to send you a check? Did you have any automobiles that were damaged?
Is there a kind of baseline for what people will receive from the federal government, or is it really all based on these questions that you're asking at intake?
Absolutely, the questions that we ask at intake. So it's very important. Let me say it again. It's very important that when you register, that you answer each question correctly. For instance, if you put off one digit in your address, So the people here at the Disaster Recovery Center, every time you answer the question, they'll repeat it back to you to make sure that it's correct. I think probably the one thing that I want you to remember, don't take to heart a letter that you get in the mail that says you've been denied. I've been trying for 11 years to get them to change that. I wish it would say, we need additional information. So don't just take the letter, drop it in the trash can, and think that, gosh, FEMA's not going to help me. But the main thing to do is, if you really want to know what the status of your account is at this time, is come on into the Disaster Recovery Center, sit down with one of my 53 app specialists that I have here, and they're very qualified and more than able to help you.
So it's really impossible for you to say, what someone with a $10,000 annual income would get, what someone with 50, with 100. It really is dependent upon their individual situation and what they tell the folks here at intake.
That's exactly right, because it all depends. Number one, do you have insurance? If you have insurance, it's going to make you whole. And I won't get into the weeds. Come on in, we'll say, even if you have insurance, there's some benefits for registering with FEMA. Thank goodness, I hope everybody had insurance. But if you don't, that's what we're here for. Just to give you an example, someone with insurance may have a $10,000 maximum fee for what we call loss of use. You realize how long that's going to take before you eat that $10,000 up in motel bills, particularly if it's going to be a couple of years before your house is back. FEMA can help in that case. Once you show receipts that you have used that $10,000 worth from your insurance company, now FEMA can help maybe.
All right, so I'm done registering here. I've answered all of the questions to the best of my ability. now where do I go? Inside the building.
Okay, it's going to depend on how we review your case. If we see that you're SBA eligible.
That's the Small Business Administration.
Exactly right. Then we're going to send you down to the SBA personnel. If we see that you have what we call other needs assistance and you are not eligible for the SBA, we'll take a look at trying to get the information or get the information from you that we need in order to facilitate what we call other needs assistance. And that involves personal property, that involves transportation, car, that includes medical, that includes storage, includes all the other things that maybe if you're not eligible for SBA that we can help you with.
As we said goodbye to Jackson, he wanted to say one more thing about what can happen in this building.
I think one of the most touching things I saw in here, I actually saw family members that hadn't seen each other since the fire, and they were in this disaster center, and they saw each other.
As we sat there at intake, I looked to the right and noticed a colorful wall filled with paintings and drawings done by children who had come through the center with their parents. The wall is filled with rainbows and big colorful dots, but also with darker depictions that clearly stem from the trauma of the day of the fire. Last weekend, in front of that area, Girl Scout troops from Plumas Lake sat handing out packages for the kids.
My name is Madeline Perrault, and I'm 11 years old.
Tell me why you're here.
Well, we're here to give kids blankets and some adults to comfort them and, like, just give them a little extra something.
Why is it important to you that you be here?
Well, it's important to me because I'm helping kids and families that have lost their homes or lost a lot of things in the fires. So,
just beyond the Girl Scout table, a whole row of non-governmental agencies, from United Way to the Red Cross to the California Fire Foundation, all sat waiting to offer more help. Back with Frank Mansell, I asked what came after registration.
Well, this is one of the largest facilities that I've seen, and I've been to about 30 disasters. So you would come here and, for instance, on our left here, we would talk to the Internal Revenue Service. There are certain deductions that are available to individuals who are affected by the fire. So there's advice here. We have on the right, we've got the United States Department of Agriculture here. They're in charge of some of the food programs that you have, as well as some housing that they might have in stock.
So what we're doing when we stop at these different agencies is giving them the information from our intake, and then they from there will tell us what we need to know.
Yes, depending on what your needs are. You'll come in here and it's kind of like a bazaar, if you like, where you can stop and say, what do you have to offer? Or I have this need. And sometimes that need is, I really need to know about land clearing. When are you going to let me back in? What do I have to do? Am I going to have to pay to clear my land? So we've got the county here, for instance, that will be talking to you about what the process is.
Frank Mansell speaking with us at the FEMA Disaster Recovery Center. It's open from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day at the old Sears building here in Chico. And that is our program for Monday, December 4th, 2018, 26 days since the fire started. We are produced by Sarah Bohannon, Mark Albert, and Phil Wilkie. Adam Ragusea composed our theme music. Special thanks today to Cameron Ford. Tomorrow, the executive director of the Butte County Housing Authority joins us to talk about a housing crisis now made manifold by an enormous population that lost homes to the fire. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.